question, we have YIJ is the number of epileptic seizures for patient I at time J. And so we modeled the log of the expected number of epileptic seizure. And we have the same Poisson regression model that we discussed last time, where we have a variable XIJ1, which is whether this is the treatment variable, whether the patient has been assigned or not assigned to the placebo. And that is the period. So whether there was the epileptics, they were counting on the epileptic seizure prior randomization or after randomization. And then we have the offset. So just to make sure all of you guys remember the data structure here, you have 8 weeks baseline. Then at this time, it gets the randomization, whether it's the placebo or the treatment. And then the number of epileptic seizure is measured at the 2 weeks interval afterwards, right? And so we said that we have to include the offset because there is an irregular time point. And we have analyzed all of these using a marginal Poisson regression model. And now what I'm doing, I'm just showing you an analysis of the same identical data set, but with a Poisson regression with a random intercept, and then we're also going to do Poisson regression with random intercept and random slope. Okay? And mostly focusing on the parameter interpretation, how you can write it up. So, so that's the model. And so the difference is now we have this gamma I, which is beta 0 plus Yukon I, so we allow for the random intercept. And we will see now what is the interpretation of this model. So as a usual, and as I do all the time, the only way to figure out what is the parameter interpretation is actually try to rewrite the mean, the expected value of yij, which will be the expected number of seizures, under different values of the covariate. So then you get a sense of what is the interpretation of the expected number of epileptic seizures under the different combinations. So for example, we know from if you read the first line, basically it's telling you that the expected number of epileptic seizures for the placebo at baseline, so at visit zero, is expressed as 8 times e to gamma I. So basically what we are allowing now is that we allow you there is heterogeneity between subjects in the expected number of epileptic seizures at baseline and under the placebo. So everyone will have his own number of epileptic seizures to start with. And then we can go ahead and continue to write up the expected number of epileptic seizures as a function of model parameters for the different combination of the covariates. So the equation 2, 3, and 4, basically the only thing I did, I specified the Poisson regression for the different values of the covariates. Okay? So, you know, you see here, this was the equation that you have. If you assume that both x1 and x2 are 0, this is 0, this is 0, 0, and 0, at baseline, this is 8, and so you basically you get that the expected value yj given gamma I when x1 and x2 are both equal 0 is going to be equal to 8 e of gamma I. Okay? And then you can do the same thing for all for different value of the different covariates. So in this way, you have all of these, and then you see, then you can start say, well, if you want to calculate the ratio of expected seizures after and before the treatment in the placebo group, okay, so what you do, you focus on the placebo, and if you take this quantity divided by this quantity, it tells you what is the change in the expected number of epileptic seizure at post-treatment versus pre-treatment when you are being assigned to the placebo. Right? Can you see that? And so if you take the second row divided by the first row, which is this one, you get this number. So this is the ratio of the expected number of epileptic seizure post-treatment divided by the expected number of epileptic seizures pre-treatment for the placebo group. And that's it. And you see that the interesting thing is that gamma height amplified. So it is true that we allow a subject-specific number of epileptic seizures at placebo pre-treatment, but when we're going to look at the rate of change, when we're going to look at the ratio of the expected number of epileptic seizures post-treatment versus pre-treatment within the placebo, that is a common for everybody. Okay? Similar, now if you take the fourth row and you divide it by the third row, it's telling you what is the ratio between the expected number of epileptic seizures post-treatment versus pre-treatement for the ProGabida group. So you take this number divided by this number, and that's what you get. Okay? And then finally, and this is what was, and then if you take now this number divided by this number, which is beta 3, it's going to be our parameter, our rate ratio. So beta 3, we do all of these, beta 3, let's see if it will fit, right here. So beta 3, it's the, our parameter of interest, it's the expected value of yj given u con I xi. Oh, I'm sorry, this is, yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, so let's see if I can get this right. X1 equal 1, x2 equal 1, divided by expected number yj, u con I, x1 equal 1, x2 equal 0. And then you have expected number yj, u con I, x1 equals 0, x2 equals 1, divided by yj, u con I, x1. Oh boy, x1 equals 0, x2 equals 0. So I hope you can get it. So beta 3, it's the numerator. It's basically this quantity will be the expected number of epileptic seizure for post-treatment and the ProGabida. So X1 and X2 are both equal to 1, which is this quantity, divided by the expected number of epileptic seizure still within the ProGabida. So X1 is equal to 1, but pre-treatment. So that is the ratio between the average number of epileptic seizure, post-treatment, pre-treatment for the ProGabida, which is this number divided by this number divided by this number. And then the denominator is the same thing, which is this number divided by this number. And so if you take now this divided by this, you get beta 3. Are you lost? Okay. So if, you know, basically the another way to rewrite this is just replace each of these by this expected number that basically is the value of the covariate there, and you will get the beta 3. So beta 3 is our parameter of interest, which is the rate ratio, which you see depends, all these expectations are all conditional to u con I. Okay? But because we have a model only with a random intercept, although we allow a different baseline and a subject-specific baseline and the number of epileptic seizures, when we're going to calculate this rate ratio, actually, the rate ratio is common to everyone, okay, and it is equal to beta 3, okay? Are you guys clear how this beta 3 comes coming from? If you're not, I'll reiterate one more time. You guys okay? Okay, so, and actually, that's good, because you're okay, because I read up. So yes, so here it is. So if you have it here as a double check, so you actually can do it again by yourself. So E of beta 3 represents the ratio of the seizure rate post versus pre-randomization for the treatment group divided by seizure rates post versus randomization for the control group. So beta 3 is basically this quantity. CE of beta 3 is this quantity divided by this quantity. Okay, so you will just go back and can recheck the calculation. So a negative value of beta 3 indicates that a relatively large fraction of total seizures in the treatment group occur before rather than after randomization as compared to the placebo group. So you basically want a sharper decline in the number of epileptic seizures pre-post treatment under the pro-gabida group than under the placebo. And so you want the E of beta 3 is less than 1. That means you want the beta 3 is less than 0. So we can fit our Poisson regression model with a random intercept, and bless you. And we get a coefficient which is, it's negative, but it's not, you know, there is some modest evidence. Okay, so the standard error is 0.65. So you actually, you're not going to basically say it's not statistically significant. Now, if you go in the textbook and they do some actual diagnostic and calculate the AIC, it actually comes out that this model is not fitting well. It's not fitting the data well. It's not accounting for all the sources of variation. And so I'm just going to show you and illustrate what happened if you actually now allow for a random intercept and a random, yes, sorry. I was going too fast, probably, yes. This one? Yes. So you're saying if we compare these divide with these? Yes. So what you're saying is that by including, yes, you're correct. I mean, by including a main effect, so by including the covariate X2, which is the period, as a main effect, we are saying that, yeah, so you raise an important point. So what she's saying is that, see here, prior a week, right? So this is the baseline period. Because we include this variable X1, we are saying even prior to the randomization, we are allowing a different number of epileptic seizures between the treatment and the control. And, you know, you correctly said, well, that doesn't make much sense. So basically what we are calculating, if you go to the table, 8 weeks, during these 8 weeks, so this is when no one has been assigned to one place to another yet, okay? But still, what we are saying that the expected value of epileptic seizure given the random effect for X, for X1 equals 0, X2 equals 0, it's different than the number of epileptic seizure gamma 1, so we'll fill X1 equals 1, and X2 equals 0. So basically, so having fixed X2 equals 0, we are both saying that we are during the visit 0, right? And so, why this is true? Because we are adding this variable as a main effect. And so you raise an important point. We shouldn't allow for that. The only reason why X1 is as a main effect is because what we are very, very interested in is the interaction. And sometimes into a regression model, when you specify the interaction, you also tend to specify the main effect. And in fact, that's something now we have to look at for it. If you will get statistically significant effect of beta 1, then we'll be in trouble. So I bet, and now let's verify that beta 1 will not be significant. But that was a great question. Yeah. Yes. That was one way. Yeah. I mean, because why would be? What do you mean? I don't know that. I mean, sorry. Right. One way to look at will be to rewrite this model without this. Right, and receive what's the parameter interpretation without this main effect, and you will just have slightly different function of your your parameters. So it's a little. This main effect for the period. The main effect for the period. It's a little fishy. Yeah. That's such a good point, and I think there are. At the end of the last lecture, when it was on Monday, also someone else pointed out that why we are so interested about the rate ratio, you could be interested to other parameters as well, but that's just an example. So I'm sure there are many other smarter ways to analyze this data set. The only thing I want to show you is how you write up the different parameters when now you have a model with a random intercept and a random slope. And so, you see, now we not only say that there is a beta 0 plus ui1, but now we also say that there is a random slope for the treatment, okay, for x2. Remember, x2 is the treatment binary variable. And then we allow for a bivariate distribution for the distribution of the random effect. So in this way, we are assuming there might be heterogeneity among subjects in the ratio of expected counts before and after the randomization. And this heterogeneity can be measured by the parameter G22. So you see what's happened now is that if you take the ratio of epileptic seizures post to pre-treatment for the placebo, it indeed also varies by subject, okay? So before we were allowing that there was a between subjects variability in the baseline number of epileptic seizure, but the ratio of expected number of epileptic seizure post-randomization or pre-randomization was common to everyone. And now, by allowing a random intercept, you also allow that the change in the average number of epileptic seizures pre-randomization, post-randomization can vary from subject to subject, which is a way of capturing the fact that different people can respond to a treatment in a different way. And so, similarly, you see that the ratio of the seizure counts in the pro-gabida group post to pre-treatment is also subject-specific. So you see now, again, although you allow, actually it's interesting because although you allow that the change in the average number of epileptic seizures, pre-randomization, post-randomization is subject-specific, the rate ratio, again, which is our beta 3, which will be this quantity divided by this quantity, will be constant for everyone. Okay? So there is a heterogeneity in the baseline. There is heterogeneity as everyone responds to the treatment. But the rate ratio in terms of whether the rate of change or the number of epileptic seizure for the treatment it's lower than the rate of change, or higher the rate of change in epileptic seizure for the placebo, it's common to everyone. So see, to see that, you take this quantity, you divide it by this quantity, which is this, not this expression, E of beta 2 plus UI 2 plus beta 3, divided by E of beta 2 plus UI 2, and you get again E of beta 3. Okay. And I mean, the way of writing after this parameter, I'm sure I will show you so many times, is always the same. Specify different number of covariates and then write the different ratio. So to just compare the results, here, I'm dropping everything. Under model one, so remember we always have this patient 207 that is an outlier. So they did an analysis with and without the patient. So the model with complete data, we have that. So you see, this is the treatment by time interaction, which is the parameter estimate for beta 3. Under the model with random intercept only, you get a more negative effect at the not significant. Not significant when you drop the patient 207. This is the estimate of the heterogeneity, okay, of the random effect under the two model. And so you see that actually when you had the model for with random intercept and random slope, actually I was staring at this number. So this is significant because it's 0.07, right? So this is significant. And then when you had also the random slope, actually it's not significant anymore. Okay? And you see, the interesting thing is that now, because you have allowed for a random intercept and random slope, the model is more robust, better accounts for heterogeneity between subjects, and actually the two sets of parameter estimates are very similar now, even if you include or exclude the outlier. Okay? Because now the model has enough flexibility to better account for outlier patients. And so there is really substantial, you know, well, again, you have then to take, as you know, the same way as we did our figure where we have a distribution of the normal distribution for the random effect, and then you calculate the two probability. Well, you can do exactly the same exercise now. But instead of calculating the two probability, you calculate the two expected number of epileptic seizures over 2 weeks interval. And so based on now your distribution of random effect, you can get a sense of what is the variability in the baseline number of epileptic seizures in your population, as well as looking at these, what is the variability in the rate of change in the epileptic seizure in your population. Okay. So that's basically now. I'm you know, one of the reasons why I give you and illustrate the random effect models with random intercept and random slope as the detail of the class is because on the fourth term, which is going to be 10 days from now, it's going to be the second sequence of this class, which is a multi-level model, which will be taught by Dr. Lewis. And what he does, a multi-level model, this example, the Poisson regression model with a random intercept and random slope, is a multi-level model. So on the fourth term, there are going to be other 8 weeks, which the only thing you do will be to interpret and fit model like that. Okay? So it will be basically linear regression, Poisson regression, logistic regression, with random intercept and random slopes, also accounting for different level of correlation. So in longitudinal data analysis, we always thought only the fact that each person is his own cluster, in terms that you have the repeated measurements within a subject are clusters. But you could think about different level of clustering. So the classical example, which is often, for example, in quality of care type of application, is that you have a patient that are nested within hospitals that are nested within a HMO that can be nested between a state, and so on, right? So in LDA, we account for only one level of correlation, which is the repeated measurements for a single subject, and the multi-level course will start from that by only assuming one level of correlation, going much more deep into this type of modeling, and then extended where you have a several level of correlation. Now, the situation that you could have a longitudinal data set where you have repeated measurements for a patient, and then you have that the patients are treated within hospitals. And so you will not only expect that the blood pressure for a particular patient will be correlated, but also you will think that the quality of care for patients in the same hospital will be similar to patients into different hospitals. So, you know, so you could have a different level of correlation that needs to be taken into account, and so you will have not only one level specification of random effect distribution, but you could have a different level of random effect distribution. But the idea is basically it's the same. Okay, so what I'm going to do is now to, for the next half an hour or so, to just basically cruise through the entire material of the course. And it's amazing, like, you know, in 8 weeks classes, I'm going to cover it now in 40 minutes. So stay with me in my ride. One thing I would like you to do is anywhere in the ride, you can always raise your hand and say, stop! Can you please? Okay? So this is what we have done, and actually that's something that please make me feel good. I hope it will make you feel good, because there's so much stuff we have covered. So we started by giving you a definition of what is a longitudinal data set, and basically why we need special methods, and that was exactly what I was saying, because you have the repeated measurements within a subject, you know, are correlated, and we have to account for that correlation. And so then what we did, we went through all the different examples, and now you know that what I start saying at the beginning, that you will be sick of this data set. I hope that, you know, by now you are, because we haven't analyzed a nauseam. And we really made the point of the importance of separating cross-sectional information from longitudinal information. That was my toy example of reading ability and what was the age reading ability, and the fact that you can, when you have a longitudinal data set, you can compare change over time in the covariate with change over time in the outcome within a subject, as well as you can compare change in the covariate with change in outcome across subjects. And that's, you know, why, you know, longitudinal data analysis is so powerful. In fact, you know, we have this little regression model here, where if you can always rewrite yij. Please ignore this part. That was something you also had in your homework. And so the first equation, when you take the expected value of yi1 equal to xi1 beta c. Beta c is our cross-sectional parameter, because you compare change in x versus change in y across people at baseline. And the beta l is our longitudinal parameter, because you look at whether change in the covariate with respect to the baseline for a particular subject is associated with change in the outcome with respect to baseline for the same subject. And we did an application of that in the Indonesian children health study, where we looked at the effect of age or respiratory infection, and we then re-estimated the effect of the follow-up, which was change in age with respect to the child-specific baseline on respiratory infection. And we modeled the two effects in a nonlinear way, and we actually showed that the shape of the two curves are different, because these are two different parameter interpretations. So in longitudinal data analysis, when you have a time-varying covariate, you can always estimate both the cross-sectional coefficient and the longitudinal coefficient. The longitudinal coefficient is very powerful, because by comparing temporal variation in the treatment versus temporal variation in the outcome within the same subject, the coefficient beta L is not confounded by individual level risk factor. So you're really getting as close as you get to a causal type of inference, okay? When every time you do a cross-sectional analysis, you always have to worry that you measure all the characteristics that make the different subjects comparable, because you are getting the power by comparing different subjects. Then what we did, we spent kind of a lot of time on doing exploratory data analysis for continuous data, smoothing, what is an autocorrelation function. And I really hope that, you know, you learn the skill and you will use the exploratory data tools every time you have continuous data. Unfortunately, when we have a binary data count data, we are more limited. But when you have continuous data, actually, you know, things like the autocorrelation function, the variogram, are very, very useful to inform what is the structure of the correlation. But also smoothing techniques really allow you the possibility of fitting an average curve and so see how the outcome change with time on average with respect to the entire population. So then we went back to linear regression model and say, forget about longitudinal data analysis for a moment. Let's refresh our mind with ordinal least square, which is something people doing the 650 are doing anyway. And basically what we found, we basically defined the OLS, which is probably X prime, is X prime X inverse, X prime Y. That is the case where you have a model YIJ, which is equal beta 0 plus beta 1, xij plus epsilon ij, and under the case where epsilon, the correlation between epsilon ij and epsilon ij prime is equal 0. So if you have a linear regression model, or even if you have a longitudinal data, under the assumption of no correlation, or another way to say, under the assumption that our covariance matrix is equal to sigma squared times the identity matrix, you do ordinal least square, and we look a little bit at the geometric interpretation. We define a likelihood function for linear regression model. And then we extended all of that by basically by going from this assumption to the assumption where the correlation between epsilon ij and epsilon j prime is different than zero. And so we allow for a covariance matrix V. And so what we did, we said, well, in this case, you can assume that my yi has a multivariate normal distribution with mean xi beta and the covariance matrix B, okay? So, and then we said, well, now we have the likelihood function. We can always estimate this parameter by maximizing the likelihood function. And we started by basically, you know, there was one lecture where basically suffer with the notation, which will have all these metrics to just tell you what is a vector, what is a matrix, what is a covariance matrix, and so on. I'm sure you remember that. And then we said, after all of these, we started by specifying parametric model for the covariance matrix. And the simple one was the uniform correlation model, where basically our covariance matrix was V times sigma squared, and then basically you have your correlation matrix as one on the main diagonal and row. So say, let's start with the simple case as possible. Well, our covariance matrix has a uniform correlation structure. And then we also discussed quite extensively the correspondence between a uniform correlation model and a model with a random intercept, and how when you have continuous data, these two models are perfectly equivalent. And when in one case you have a population average or a marginal model, which rho is the within cluster correlation, and then you could also specify a model with a random intercept where the parameter rho is the ratio of the variance between divided by the total variance. Okay? And so that is something very, very important to keep in mind, because that's something that you will deal with, you know, very, very often. And so you know that now there is a perfect equivalence. when you have a continuous data between a marginal model with a uniform correlation structure and a model with a random intercept. Then we moved to an exponential correlation model where you just had this autoregressive structure of order one, and where in this case you allow a little more general representation of your covariance matrix, where you allow that the correlation actually decline out as the time difference increase. So after we have if it's an AR2, well, I don't know. So the reason why an exponential correlation model, we call it AR1, is because in the same way there was the correspondence between a uniform correlation model and the model with a random intercept, we show there was a correspondence between an exponential correlation model and a model, an autoregressive model of order one, which we say alpha, it's, you know, j is equal alpha zero plus alpha one, a, you know, plus beta ij, right? That was the correspondence we show. And so that is AR1. Now, what you're asking me now, let's assume that we say epsilon ij is equal alpha zero plus alpha one, epsilon j is minus 1 plus alpha 2, epsilon j minus 2 plus dij. Okay, this will be an AR2. Now I don't know what will be the covariance, the correlation matrix that will correspond from this. It's probably, it could be trivial, but it doesn't come up in my mind yet, so I don't know. But you could. I'm not sure, but you can run in SAS. Can you assume AR2 instead of AR1? Have you ever? I don't think so. So the only reason why, when you talk about an exponential correlation model in STADA or in other software package, you say AR1 is because it is the perfect correspondence with the exponential correlation model and autoregressive structure of order one. Now, as soon as you assume something different in autoregressive structure of order two, it will definitely will correspond to another covariance matrix, but it will not be this one. So after we defined the uniform correlation structure and the exponential correlation structure, then you have to estimate the unknown parameters of your V. And so that's how we introduce the weighted least square, which is beta hat W, which is X prime V inverse, X prime inverse, X prime V inverse Y. And this is the definition of the weighted least square. And we say the weighted least square is a maximum likelihood estimate where W is equal to V inverse. And then we said, well, but we don't know the inverse, how we estimate the inverse? Well, by doing maximal likelihood estimation. So by doing maximal likelihood estimation, you can estimate your V, and then you get your weighted least square with the correct V. Then we gave one specific example where, in the case of where you have a perfect balanced design, you actually can ignore the correlation and use ordinally squared. There was a very, very specific situation, which basically you have the same number of people observed the same number of time, and the time interval were equally spaced. And so there was, you know, one particular scenario where the OLS were fully efficient. And then we moved into robust estimation of a covariance matrix, which was a little, you know, tricky. This is always a little tricky. And this is a situation where you don't want to specify a parametric model for your covariance structure. And you have a model where your treatment is an categorical variable. So you know, you have, I'm sorry, yes, your covariate of interest is a categorical. So you cannot do, and I remember sometimes we had the conversation saying, why don't always do robust estimation? And some probably said, yeah, you know, I think we should do it all the time. Well, yes, when your covariate is categorical. If you have a continuous covariate, you actually are not unable to do it. And so if you have a categorical variable, and there was a classical example of the ozone trees, they grow of the tree size under an ozone chamber or not, and say, well, in this case, what you do, you feed a saturated model, so you calculate the residuals with respect to all possible time treatment interaction, and then you can estimate your covariance matrix non-parametrically. Now, doing robust estimation is something that works pretty well if you have a small number, if you have short sequences, and you have a lot of measurements for each sequence, because by doing a non-parametric estimation of your covariance matrix, you have to have good power for estimating every single element of your covariance matrix. And sometimes, by looking at your covariance matrix that you have estimated non-parametrically, if all the elements of the diagonal are very similar to each other, then you can rerun the model by using a uniform correlation structure. Or if you have the correlation decay quite substantially, you can use that as a guidance and do an exponential correlation model. So then what we did, we got more fancy in terms of say, well, after we learn how to fit the variogram, we say, well, by looking at the variogram, remember, you can actually be more and more complex in terms that you can allow, by expecting the variogram, you can basically model your covariance matrix in a richer way than simply uniform or an exponential. And so basically, we look at different combination of measurements of the serial correlation plus measurement error, random intercept plus measurement error, and so on. So by expecting the variogram, there are different models, more complex models for the covariance matrix that we can look at. And we had the Nepal data set where we actually analyzed this data under many of these models. This, I remember, was the time when I got the flu, and that was when Serena did the data analysis. Right, so that was, we also analyzed it by using the CD4 cell example. Yeah, so we did for looking at this parametric model for the covariance matrix, so we did the Nepal data set, we did the CD4 data set, we did the protein contents of milk that we did together, and we also did the body weight of cows. And in all four data sets, we started looking at the variogram, expecting the variogram and feeding different parametric models for the covariance structure and comparing the estimates of the regression coefficients and the standard error under this different model. And also there was a quite extensive discussion also by Serena looking at the AIC in terms of identifying goodness of fit and, you know, one of the, you know, how to basically choose the model. So this completed all, which was really probably, you know, big chunk of the course of analysis of longitudinal data where the outcome is continuous. And we look at from many different angles, from exploited analysis, we went actually pretty theoretical in defining ordinally square, in defining a likelihood function for vectors of measurements, which was the multivariate normal distribution, in defining covariance matrix, and so on, right? And so to then, we switched to, well, what happened now when you have repeated measurements which are not continuous, could be binary, it could be count. So that's where we refreshed our mind with the generalized linear models, defining what is a logistic regression, what is a Poisson regression, and also looking into the random effect model more carefully. So, please. Is exactly right. So I'm going there now. Yes.
So for the continuous part, if you're doing a random effect model and you're getting whatever the covariance is, right? If you're getting
logistic regression, because that will have two different parameter interpretation. So in logistic regression, the fact that you use a marginal model or a random effect model, your common slope, you know, has a different interpretation, is estimating two different things. In where if you have a continuous data, a marginal model, random effect model, your common intercept estimate the same thing. So it's the same parameter. Well, in the categorical data, you can fit the two models.
Right.
As far as you always have, you know, clear in mind that when you estimate the individual level, when you estimate the odds ratio under marginal model, you estimate an odds ratio under the random effect model, the interpretation of the two odds ratio is different.
Right.
When you have continuous data and you estimate a slope, like, you know, a rate of change, this rate of change under the random effect model and the rate of change under the marginal model has the same meaning, the same interpretation. You can get slightly different estimates, but it's, you know, it's because, you know, you have two different modeling assumptions, but the interpretation of the parameter is the same. No, you can't. Right. Exactly. So in fact, this is where I'm going now, because what we did, we didn't generalize the linear model. We actually went back to the linear model, and that's where we take. And I think this is really another very, very critical lecture, I would say, because that's where we compare these two situations. We compare the linear model where you have E of yij, which is equal to, let's say, beta 0 plus beta 1 tij, and that is your population average model. And then you have your random effect model, which you take E of yij given u con I, which is equal to beta 0 plus u con I. By the common slope. Then this one is a population average. So if you take this average and you average with respect to everybody, you get back beta 0 plus beta 1 tij. Because if you average all of these curves, you still go back your population average curve here. So then, when if you have a logistic regression, know that that is the logit of probability of yj given mu con I, which is a beta 0 star, and that's why we started with a star, plus u con I plus beta 1 star, say tij, and then we compared with the population average logistic regression, yij, which is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 tij. And so the example that we had is now the interpretation of this parameter is different interpretation of this parameter, because this is gonna update individual level odds when this is a population average odd. Okay? And so that's where really we went to great detail to show that although when you have a continuous data, the bottom line is when you have continuous data, when how you model your covariance matrix, it still leaves intact the interpretation of your parameter regression, of your regression coefficient. When in binary data and count data, if you allow a random effect, the interpretation of your parameters change. And so you have to be aware of that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I have the same question, but I remember in our lecture, and there's a logistic model.
When they point estimate over the standard error of this point estimate, they will be equal.
Yes, so that's true. So what we did is when you have a logistic regression, so only for logistic regression, so I was actually starting some confusion. Only for logistic regression, we showed that your absolute value beta is always of beta star, and there was this equation that was depending on G. We said that beta was something like 1 plus 4 G minus 1 half, something like beta star, right? And it is true, actually, that we said that the beta hat divided by the standard error of beta hat should be similar to beta hat star divided by the standard error of beta hat star. So to tell the full story, so it is true that the interpretation of beta star and beta 1 are different. The interpretation are different. But only for logistic regression, you tend to have that if one is significant, the other one should be significant as well. And the difference between the point estimates of the two will be as much as different as larger is the variance of the random effect. But that will not be true because of that property, as much as I described in the textbook, only apply for logistic regression but does not apply for Poisson regression. Yeah. Okay. So then what we did, we went to marginal logistic regression model and the generalized estimating equation. We introduced a generalized estimating equation because when you have a vector of binary data, it's very hard to specify a Laplace function for a vector of binary data. If you have a vector of continuous data, that was easy. We move from a univariate normal distribution to a multivariate normal distribution. But for binary data, the Laplace function is pretty complex and untractable. So that's how we introduced the idea of generalized estimating equation, which allow to estimate, give consistent and efficient estimates of the parameters by solving our generalized estimating equation, which is a multivariate generalization of the score equation without the need of specifying a Laplace function. And so that's where really started to be appropriate to use XTGE. We also said that for continuous data, XTGE use indeed a multivariate normal distribution, so it will provide the maximum likelihood estimate. So we explained GE, and we did two examples, the 2x2 crossover trial and the Indonesian children study. So we estimate these two data sets. We analyze it by generalized estimating equation for a logistic regression. In this particular case, if you go back here, that's where we split the longitudinal information from the cross-sectional. So we estimate all these parameters using GEE, but also looking at, the longitudinal effect versus the cross-sectional effect. And then we did a Poisson regression, similar thing, for the epileptic seizures. And this time, we went actually, this was the review of last year, so we actually did one more step. And so the last one was we did a random effect. GLN, where basically we did the logistic regression model regression with random intercept, and again we reanalyzed the 2x2 crossover trial at the Indonesian children study with a random intercept, and then we did the Poisson regression. The Poisson regression with random intercept and with random intercept plus random slope. And that was for the epileptic.